And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaketh." And he, Jacob, said, "I will not let thee go, except thou bless me." And he said unto him, "What is thy name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed." And Jacob asked him and said, "Tell me, I pray thee, thy name." And he said, "Wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name?" And he blessed him there. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, the face of God. For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. And as he passed over Peniel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. Therefore the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh, unto this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh in the sinew that shrank. I want us this evening to look at verses 29 to 32 and complete this passage about Jacob at the brook Jabbok and his life-changing experience there. Let us just remind ourselves of what happened as we saw last week from verse 24. Jacob is alone, and it is night time, but he is not alone. There is another who is with him. Jacob finds that as he begins to pray about the next day and the prospect of meeting Esau, that dreaded encounter which has been like a spectre for so long now, as he begins to pray about this for deliverance and protection, and as his prayer intensifies, he finds that he is, in the words of Isaiah 64 verse 7, he has stirred up himself to take hold of God. That's a good verse, isn't it? To stir yourself up and take hold of God. We sometimes say our prayers. We sometimes really pray. But we sometimes stir ourselves up to take hold of God. And then we really, really pray. And as he does that, as he lays hold upon the Lord in spiritual exercise, because he's really desperate, and if he does not succeed in getting the Lord to come in for him the next day, then as far as he's concerned, all is finished. So as he lays hold upon the Lord in spiritual exercise, he finds it is turning into a physical exercise, a physical experience. Verse 24, "And there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day." Now this divine human visitor is God's son before his incarnation, called here and elsewhere the angel, or the angel of the Lord. And we know that God's son often made visits to men in the form of an angel or a man, and he had a physical substance to him to anticipate his taking human flesh forever in the fullness of time. Well, it is clear that this mysterious combatant has won the wrestling, because Jacob ends up crippled in a measure from the encounter, and yet Jacob comes off blessed, so blessed. And it's clear that Jacob has got a greater blessing out of this than his mere deliverance from Esau and from deadly danger the next day. As he is lamed through this combat, he finds that all he can do is cling hold upon this mysterious personage and hold on and say he will not let him go until he gets a blessing. And it's not a specified blessing, it's a blessing which is more general to himself. Not what he wants out of this thing, but the Lord himself. And he finds, in fact, that the Lord gives himself, and the Lord does give him a life-changing blessing. His name is changed, his character is changed, his future is sorted. Everything really changes from this point on. It's like a watershed in Jacob's life. And really, things have changed now. What started out as a specific request that was rather self-centered on behalf of himself and his family turned into a longing for the Lord himself, which is granted to him. And he can never be the same again, for he has had this encounter with God. And dear friends, that's sometimes the best thing that can happen to us when we pray. We start on one tack, which we think is the great priority, the great thing we need, and we're specific about it. But the Lord deals with us in prayer and reveals himself to us, reveals more about ourselves perhaps as well, and we find ourselves asking for something different, something that is more to do with the glory of God rather than the benefit of ourselves. And the Lord gives us what we should have asked for, more of himself, a nearer experience of him perhaps, and we come away and prayer has changed us. Not that prayer has changed things, but prayer has changed us. And what a blessing then. Sometimes it happens like that, and we are surprised and we are amazed. Let me give you a specific illustration. You may remember I've told you this illustration before, but it well serves to explain what I mean. This is a case of a Salvation Army officer and his wife who had a godly and delightful daughter, the only child. And this daughter was a lovely Christian, and she had felt called to the mission field. And naturally the parents were delighted and were behind her, and they were looking forward to seeing her daughter serving the Lord abroad. And then she was struck down by a very serious illness. And it changed everything, of course. And so this couple obviously prayed and prayed and prayed. And you can imagine what the burden of their prayer was. But as they prayed, and as they were stirred up to lay hold upon God on behalf of their daughter and her future in the Lord's work, they found themselves unable to pray for recovery. And they had no liberty to pray for that. It seemed as if the Lord was dealing with them. And instead, they were given a large measure of grace to submit to whatever the Lord's will might be. And they were brought to this place of utter surrender to God over this matter. And the daughter died. And afterwards, they felt a tremendous sense of peace. And they turned to each other and they said, "This is what must be the peace of God in Philippians 4 and verse 7. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." Now you see, that's a very profound thing. But that was really an encounter with the Lord in prayer, whereby the Lord changed their praying and he changed them. And in fact, he had his way. And that can happen, you see. And it was like this for Jacob. He passed on from being obsessed with Esau and the danger and everything else, and instead was wholly taken up with God and came away changed. It was rather like Matthew 5 verse 8. "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." You see, we are not pure in heart often in our praying. We have mixed motives. We have wrongly directed aims and so on. Often and sometimes the Lord has to deal with us. And Jacob has had his priorities and ambitions purified. Started out with Esau and their safety, and ends up by clinging on to the Lord and wanting all that God wanted. And so he gets this turning point in his life, and it's commemorated by the Lord giving him a new name, not Jacob, now supplanter, grabber of other people's things by stealth. Not Jacob anymore, but Israel, a prince with God, someone who prevails in a princely fashion with God. And Jacob commemorates the occasion by naming the place, verse 30, Peniel, the face of God, or Penuel. I have seen God face to face. Well, isn't that a blessed thing? Isn't Jacob a more godly man after this? But the wonderful thing is, dear friends, he obtained the specific thing he was asking for too. Because look, if you turn to the next chapter, chapter 33 and verse 4, you find that when he has to meet Esau, from his encounter with God to the encounter with Esau, we find Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And look at verse 10. Jacob seems to allude back to his wrestling with the Lord in prayer. Verse 10, therefore I have seen thy face, Esau, as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. God had wrought for him and come in for him, and even given him the thing he wanted. How good the Lord is, isn't he? That he does more for us than we ever imagined he would. You'll never lose. You'll never lose when you yield to God and you are changed, and that he blesses us on his terms. Well, that's Jacob. Let's finish this passage now from verses 29 to 32. And I want us to do this simply by comparing this experience at Peniel with his previous experience in chapter 28 at Bethel. You remember the angel ladder and that encounter with the Lord there. And I suggest that if we compare the two for the purposes of our study this evening, we shall find that the similarities are instructive and they have lessons for us. This is the second real encounter with God now. Bethel, first of all, and now Peniel. And they have things in common, although they are different, and these can be helpful to us. And I've got four things I want to highlight from this comparison. And the first is this. They were at times of desperate need. And how wonderful it is, dear friends, that the Lord is prepared to meet us in a special way in times of great need. In chapter 28, of course, it was that Jacob was running from Esau, his brother. It's Esau, wasn't it? That was the center of the problem. He was running away from Esau, running away from home, getting clear of the family, because Esau had vowed to kill him, Jacob, as soon as Isaac had died, and he was running away to Paddan Aram to his uncle Laban. He fled from the face of his brother. Well, here in chapter 32, Jacob is going to Esau. He's got to meet him again after these 20 years. And if anything, it's this second that's more frantic for Jacob, because now you see he's more vulnerable, isn't he? More is at stake. 20 years before, he was running away preserving his own life. 20 years later, he's got to meet Esau and he's going to him, but it's not only his life, it's his wives, his children, livestock, servants, everything. He's more frantic over this. Times of desperate need. In the one case, the Lord gave him this dream vision of the heaven opened and the ladder and the angels. In this case now, the Lord meets with him as he wrestles in prayer, both to help him over Esau. But dear friends, the lesson is this: There are some actions that we may have done in the past that will catch up with us. And for the second time, Jacob is in trouble and he's in danger, and he's got to try to be preserved from this trouble, Esau. You see, especially in those actions that have harmed other people, they'll never go away. At least there are some actions that will never go away until they are dealt with. And what Jacob did to Esau in stealing his blessing and his birthright, they weren't dealt with 20 years before. They'd not been dealt with over 20 years, and now he's got to meet Esau. What's going to happen? You can't run away. You can be blessed by God, but you might still have to face the consequences. And that wonderful vision of heaven opened and the ladder and the angels, and this wonderful encounter with this heavenly visitor in prayer, both of them transporting experiences, but Jacob has got to come down to earth, and the thing has got to be faced. But the wonderful difference is now the Lord is preparing him to face it. Times of desperate need, but not that desperate that Jacob cannot count upon the presence and the help of God. You see, the Lord does not usually spirit us away from our problems and troubles and the consequences of wrongs we've done. Things have got to be faced and sorted out and settled, but the Lord is with us in them, and thank God for that. They were times of desperate need. And perhaps, dear friends, there are times of desperate need for us as well, over one thing or another. Maybe it's our own fault, maybe it's not our own fault. The Lord is prepared to meet with us. He's the God of Bethel. He's the God of that place called Peniel, where men see him face to face in prayer by faith. And he'll be with us, the God of Jacob. Secondly then, they were real encounters with God to help Jacob. Now in chapter 28, as I've said before, it was really at a kind of a distance. It was in the form of a dream vision. We've known this chapter 28 for years, haven't we? It's a marvellous chapter. Heaven opened, the Lord above speaking to Jacob, the ladder up on the earth whose top reached to heaven, the angels going up the ladder for Jacob, coming down the ladder with their orders to carry out on Jacob's behalf, and the Lord promising good to Jacob. Marvellous! Dream vision. The veil was drawn aside. He was shown how things are in the spiritual realm for Jacob. But now in chapter 32, dear friends, it's a nearer experience, isn't it? There is even a physical dimension to this now. The Lord is right there in front of him, and Jacob finds he's able to actually cling on to the Lord, and the Lord actually touches him and deals with him. The Lord has come so much nearer now, as of course has happened by the incarnation. If the coming of Jesus is typified by the angel ladder, whose bottom was set up on earth and whose top reached to heaven, Jesus is the way. This now is even more of a wonderful picture of the coming of Jesus in the flesh, right near, to bless us, close at hand. And you see, so much so that Jacob felt he could even ask his identity. Verse 29, tell me, I pray thee, thy name. In other words, it doesn't mean just what are you called, like it would be for us. What's your name? What's your handle? That, it's not like that. It's who are you? The name is the person. Who are you? And notice how the Lord replies, verse 29, wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name? He doesn't rebuke him, because it was a pious desire and wish, wasn't it? But what the Son of God says is, you can't know my name yet. It's not going to be revealed at this point. It's too soon. Why are you asking for my name? It's not the time. The fullness of the time has not come. If you turn to Judges 13 and verse 18, you find exactly the same happening to Manoah, the wife of Samson's mother. Manoah and his wife were the parents of Samson, and the angel of the Lord visits them in the same way as he visited Jacob. And again, Manoah, so overcome by this great, glorious privilege, asks the name. Judges 13 and verse 17. And Manoah said unto the angel of the Lord, "What is thy name, that when thy saying comes to pass, we may do thee honour?" And the angel of the Lord said unto him, "Why askest thou thus after my name, seeing it is secret?" See, no one knows the name Jesus at this point. It's not been revealed. Secret. And of course, we've got to wait until Matthew 1 and verse 21, haven't we, for the answer, where the angel says to Joseph, "Thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins." This was a real encounter with the Son of God, pre-incarnate, or incarnate temporally, for the purpose of appearing to Jacob. But his name could not be known. But we can sympathize with Jacob's desire to know more of who he is, more of what he's like, his identity, more and more of him. However, let's just pursue this for a minute. Go with me to Genesis 49 and verse 10. Jacob now is in the last days of his life, blessing each of his sons, who will be the heads of the tribes of the children of Israel. Genesis 49 verse 10. And he makes this prophecy concerning the tribe of Judah. "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be." In other words, Judah or Judea will be a sovereign state. There'll be a scepter and the law. They'll have self-government until Shiloh come, when they will be under the power of the Roman Empire and Jesus will be born. Shiloh, meaning rest giver. From that, and it's confirmed in those wonderful words, "Come unto me, all ye that labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." So Jacob knew the name, or at least a prophecy of the name, a code name for Jesus, as it were. How did he know? How did he know what name? "Until Shiloh come." Well, F.B. Meyer, godly Christian writer on the life of Jacob, makes this suggestion, and I'll read it to you. "You will remember that at Peniel, Jacob asked the mysterious combatant his name. What answer did he receive? When Manoah asked a similar question, the angel of the Lord told him it was secret. But no such negative was spoken to Jacob. The angel simply said, 'Wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name?' And he blessed him there." I have sometimes thought that as he blessed him, he whispered in his ear this lovely title, Shiloh, which lingered in the old man's mind as the years went on and became invested with ever fuller and richer meaning as he felt to need more urgently the balm and strength which it contained. You see what he's saying? "What are you asking my name for?" Meaning, "I can't give it to you now, but I'll give you another name, Shiloh." And it did for Jacob all those years. And it is a very precious title in the Old Testament for the Lord Jesus. This was a real encounter. And the Son of God dealing with Jacob, revealing more and more of himself to this patriarch. What a, if I may put it like this, a great improvement on the dream vision at Bethel this was, wasn't it? Better than the ladder, better than the angels, better than the Lord on the top of the ladder speaking things to him. This is a real close encounter. The Lord has come closer and closer and has led Jacob on from one encounter to another. Wonderful, that's how it is, you see. The Lord leads us on from one experience to another, doesn't he? He's got more to do with us, more to show us, more to reveal to us, to get us to know him more and more. So times of desperate need and real encounters with God, these two wonderful occasions. And then thirdly, they made all the difference to Jacob. What did chapter 28, what difference did that make to Jacob when he woke up in the morning? Well, we know he worshipped, he called the place Bethel and so on. But look, chapter 29 verse 1. Then Jacob went on his journey and came into the land of the people of the east, and the Lord truly was with him and blessed him and brought him safely there. But if you have a margin Bible and you look at verse 1 in the margin, you'll see that at went on his journey, it can be rendered lifted up his feet. That's a very graphic way of expressing it, more vivid than went on his journey. In other words, you see, he's like a man who has been transformed, because as he was making his way toward Bethel, running away from home and from Esau, you can imagine that it was really with almost leaden steps, sorrowful, apprehensive, unsure about the future and so on. After this experience at night, he wakes up next morning, carries on his journey, there's alacrity, there's a spring in his step, and he's going on his way now, a new man, and it's showing even in his gait, even in the way he's walking, or rather perhaps striding out. That made all the difference to Jacob. Tremendous. He now knew that he had God for his friend, and nobody need be afraid if he's got God for his friend. And he went on his journey, lifted up his feet, a new man, because of the company he knew he was now in. What about chapter 32, though? What difference did that make to Jacob? Well, look, we're told it was also a physical thing. Verse 31, as he passed over Penuel, the sun rose upon him and he halted upon his thigh. He was limping. After all, he'd had his ball and socket hip joint temporarily dislocated, and he was limping. And you see, that's very different from lifting up your feet and striding out with alacrity. But it expresses a truth. Because, dear friends, if the Lord is pleased to reveal himself to us afresh as our friend and our guide, we will walk happily along. But in this case, you see, the Lord has revealed so much more of himself to Jacob, and has so dealt profoundly with Jacob, that the man's physical strength has greatly diminished. And he's got lower and humbler, and it's as if he's limping under the weight of this spiritual blessing he's had in the presence of the Lord, face to face almost. And it tells me that the more God deals with us, the humbler we shall get. And if the Lord speaks to you and to me, reveals more of himself to us, changes us, then we shall get down and we shall be lower and lower. And there won't be a striding forth with self-importance. We'll be bowed under the real experience we've had. We'll be humbled and almost broken, and it will show in our very bearing, as it was with Jacob. You see, when David was told that far from David building God a physical house, a temple, no, no, says God, it's good that it was in your heart, and I'll bless you for the intention, but I'm going to build you a house. I'm going to build you a household, a family. I'm going to build you a dynasty of kings that will come from you. And David in 2 Samuel 7 and verse 18, you know what he did? He didn't walk tall and full of importance. He went in and he sat down before the Lord. And he said, "Who am I, O Lord? And what is my father's house that thou hast brought me hitherto?" So overcome, so humbled, so low in amazement at what the Lord has done with him and for him. That's the attitude. What are we to say then about these characters in the church sometimes who make wild claims about great blessing and experience that God has given them, and they're as proud as peacocks, strutting about the place and telling other believers that this is what they must seek and have, and giving the impression to other believers that they're second class citizens until they've been baptized in the Spirit and until they can speak in tongues and work miracles and so on, and they're just so inflated with pride and arrogance. And try and reason with them from the word, and they disdain any such notion. And try to bring them to some biblical understanding of these things, and they're above that kind of thing. And if anyone dare even begin to point out to them that they just might be deluded, the Lord has dealt with me directly. Never mind about your Bible and your minister in the church. And they make for a place where they claim they can be free to worship the Lord now with liberty and enjoyment according to the blessed. That is just so utterly inimical and a million miles away from the authentic thing that God gives when he does bless. The man goes down, the man's pride is broken, the man is bowed low and is almost limping under the weight of what God has done, and hardly dares tell anyone even. Although you'll see it on the radiant, shining face, and you'll see evidence of the fact that the Lord has met such a person. But there'll be that godly humility, like Jacob here, limping along. He's seen God face to face, and he's not going to boast about it and tell the world about it and imply that others without it are inferior to him. You see, it made all the difference to Jacob. He was a different man. And that's always how it will be, dear friends. You'll have a spring in your step and a joy to go through life with God as your friend. But the more he draws you closer and makes himself known to you, the lower down you'll get. You won't be able to get too low, so that God will have all the glory and that you will keep this special blessing. Because God gives grace to the humble. All the difference. The great hallmark of genuine godliness is humility. Because more godliness, less humanness. More of the Lord, less of self. The higher we rise with him, the lower we go in our own esteem and eyes. All the difference. And then finally, the fourth thing is this. Both places were commemorated by names, weren't they? In Genesis 28, we know what the name was. Unforgettable, wasn't it? Genesis 28 and verse 19, and he called the name of that place Bethel. Bethel. Because verse 17, this is none other but the house of God. What a place. As he saw heaven opened, as he saw the Lord in there, in heaven, and this communication between earth and heaven established, the ladder and the angels going up and down, it seemed as if that whole place was the house of God. like a temple of the Lord. Bethel, wonderful. Now, of course, chapter 32, we know what he called that place. Verse 30, we've had it already. Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, the face of God. And verse 31, Penuel, just an alternative way of spelling it, meaning the same, the face of God. It's a difference, isn't there, between the house of God and the face of God. As we said before, the face is nearer to God than in the house. And it's interesting that in the New Testament, the house of God is a picture of the church. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 15, we read, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself, writes Paul, in the house of God, which is the church of the living God. Not the physical building he's meaning, but the people, the assembly. Because God's presence there, like at Bethel, makes it the house of God. So that's the church. We refer to God's house, don't we? This place where we are, or any place where we are for meeting and worship and the means of grace. And that's a lovely thought, you see, because the one can lead to the other, can't it? If we're in the house of God, the church, what are we looking for? The face of God, to meet with him. This other place, this other experience that Jacob had. And I wonder if that's what we seek beyond all else when we come to God's house. Not Bethel only, but Peniel, the face of God. In Psalm 84 and verse 2, the psalm we sang earlier, there's an important order of things there, which is quite deliberate, isn't it, to express an important truth. Psalm 84 verse 2, David, we presume, longing to be in the temple, the house of God. He's missing it. Even the birds can find a place there by making their nests. But oh, that I might be there, says this godly psalmist. And so verse 2 he says, my soul longeth, yea, even fainteth for the courts of the Lord. That's the house of God. My heart and my flesh crieth out for the living God. Peniel, the face of God. You see, too often we can be content with the house, the courts of the Lord, can't we? We've come to church today, or we've come to Bible study and prayer meeting tonight, and that's about it. We've attended, we've met together. But you see, oh, how we long, don't we, to do more than that. Because you can't be satisfied, can you, with simply being present according to godly custom and habit. Can't be content with just meeting with the Lord's people, blessed though that is, precious though they are to us. It's not Bethel only, the house of God. It must be Peniel, the face of God. Not the courts of the Lord only, but oh, my heart and my flesh crieth out for the living God. Do we get something of that when we attend? Is that what we're after? Which by and large, what we seek we'll get. As much as we seek we'll get. As little as we seek we'll get. But oh, how wonderful when the Lord stirs up that longing, heart and flesh crying out for the living God. Oh, to meet with Jesus. Oh, to hear God's voice to me in the Word. Oh, to know him there. Oh, to be so blessed in his presence that I might go out different from how I was when I came in. Is that what we want? Is that what we pray for? Do you prepare yourself beforehand? Before coming to church, on the way to church? Prepare yourself before the weeknight meeting? You see, these things are not automatic, are they? You don't just turn up. And then it's turned on and it happens. We come prepared and seeking, waiting upon the Lord, listening, giving ourselves to worship and the means of grace, and seeking the Lord in these things. And the Lord, who was pleased to meet with Jacob at Peniel, will be pleased to meet with us accordingly. Yes, and we might well go out limping, because the Lord has dealt with us very deeply, but my, will be the better for it. We'll be so blessed. Well, may it be so, dear friends. These two places in Jacob's life, Bethel and Peniel, may they be true in our lives as well, for the glory of his name. Let us sing.